According to a new poll from the Anti-Defamation League, about a quarter of the world's population says six or more negative statements about Jews are probably true. The poll was designed to put a number on anti-Semitic attitudes worldwide and to help better fight prejudice.
Joining us now to talk about the survey and what it means is Lonnie Nassiter. He's the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, where he oversees a six-state region, which includes Wisconsin. Lonnie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
Doing fine. Well, this survey was ambitious. What did you set out to quantify here at the beginning?
We really wanted to do a comprehensive. We've done surveys before, anti-Semitism, but we really kind of focused on America and Europe, and we really felt we wanted to get a sense of the world. And through the generosity of a donor who also had these aspirations, we were able to figure out a way to commission a third party to really get a sense of the world sense of Jews, and if in fact six of the questions were answered in the affirmative, we would then deem them to have anti-Semitic attitudes. And we were able to do 101 countries, including the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So it's probably the biggest survey ever done on anti-Semitism that we have known of. It's definitely the most and the most comprehensive ADL has ever done.
And how did you define anti-Semitism for your survey?
Well, we asked the respondents 11 questions, really playing on stereotypes about Jews pertaining to loyalty, to financial, to business, to the notion that Jews only stick together, talk too much about the Holocaust, several questions that really played on stereotypes and, quite frankly, pernicious notions of Jews. And if the respondents would answer any of those 11, six of the 11 rather, or more, then we would hold those people as having strong anti-Semitic attitudes. So we took it seriously in the sense that we didn't just say if you have one of the 11, you're deemed having anti-Semitic attitudes. It had to be at least six or more. And so as a result, that's where the 26% number that you just mentioned at the beginning really kind of quantifies itself.
And let's talk about the dividing line since we're touching on it now. So if you have expressed agreement with five of those statements, mm-hmm. you fell on the other side of the divide, if six
That's right.
or more anti-Semitic attitudes. So that is something that has drawn some criticism for this survey, saying that it's a fine line to draw. How would you defend using that number right there?
Well, again, it's just a barometer, and there's no surefire way and no scientific method to do this. It's obviously much about opinions and attitudes and all the rest. So there's no direct science of how do you view it. But we felt like, and we've been doing this now for over 40 years, that given the nature of the questions and the frequency in which somebody would answer in the affirmative, having six or more would really kind of quantify that person as holding strong anti-Semitic attitudes. And we just felt like four maybe, you know, too little based on the fact it's less than 50%, but over 50%, and that has been the criteria we've now used for over 40 years, that we would deem them to have these types of attitudes. And as a result, we need to kind of do a more longitudinal approach to this and find out, you know, asking the similar questions in 3-5 years, does it change? And I think, you know, if we're going to keep things consistent, that's a big part of the study as well, as you can't change things up because then it would be an apples to oranges type of comparison.
Now, as we said, 26% of people worldwide you found to have anti-Semitic views. How does the Anti-Defamation League process that number? What do you make of it?
It was sobering. I don't think we were necessarily too shocked or surprised given the fact that we got a taste of what it's like in Europe. And we were actually really saddened by the numbers in the Middle East and North Africa. We had an inkling that it probably wasn't going to be so great, but just the overwhelming numbers of people who answered in the affirmative, you know, 74% holding strong anti-Semitic attitudes in the Middle East and North Africa, really 3 out of 4 is a really big number. And it's unfortunate, and it also means that we as an organization that's aimed at fighting anti-Semitism have our work cut out for us, and we need to take these numbers and bring it to heads of state and say there's a problem here and we'd like to be a part of the solution. We don't want to just scream from the mountaintops there's a problem and there's a lot of people that don't like Jews, but we want to figure out a way to find some commonality and get those numbers to go down and hopefully move the needle a little bit in the positive.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the details of the survey. And if we break it down by country, where did you find the strongest anti-Semitic views, the highest?
By regions, it was clearly the Middle East and North Africa. Coming in second was Eastern Europe. Actually, it was the Americas that came in quite low and Oceania that came in quite low. And Western Europe was somewhere in the middle. If you really broke it down by countries, you look at the West Bank and Gaza, and they're not countries, but they're territories, they were the highest. Iraq was a close second at 92%. And in fact, the top 16 of the countries whose respondents polled anti-Semitism, those top 16 were all from the Middle East and North Africa.
And how about the United States? How did the United States come out?
The United States came out at 9%, which is a little bit lower than we've done our domestic polling over the years. We've been charting for the last, 10 years. It's been hovering around 12 to 15%. But on the good side, that means that the numbers are continuing to go down. When we did this study asking very similar questions in 1964, close to 30% of Americans held strong anti-Semitic attitudes. Now it's down to 9%. That's great progress. I think that's a really encouraging sign that we see here. And also in Canada, it's 14%. So both here and our neighbors to the north, the numbers are significantly lower than in other parts of the world.
And as far as the lowest rates, where did you find that?
Well, interestingly, we found it in Laos, which was 0.2%, and the Philippines was 3%. So two areas in Asia were incredibly low. Also, those countries also said that they hadn't met many respondents that had never met a Jew before, but it didn't mean that the stereotypes corresponded to them having anything negative to say, which was really encouraging. Sweden and the Netherlands, in terms of Western Europe, they polled very low at 5% and 4%. But going back to the Asia thing, which I think is really interesting about this study, and if you go to the Global ADL 100 website, which is a terrific site that we put together, you can actually compare countries and see exactly how each country polled. And you can compare, for example, South Korea versus Laos in Asia, and you notice that in South Korea, it's significantly higher and to the tune of over 50%, but yet Laos is 0.2%. So then you got to start asking questions like, so what distinguishes a South Korea from a Laos in terms of anti-Semitism? Is it political? Is it in educational systems? Is it cultural? And that's really where I think a lot of people, not just the ADL, can really dig into these findings and get a sense of why and how.
We're talking right now with Lonnie Nossiter, Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League, where he oversees a six-state region, which includes Wisconsin. And we're talking about a new survey now from the ADL, which shows that about 25% of the people worldwide hold anti-Semitic beliefs.
And we want to hear from you. What do you make of these survey findings that our guest is sharing? Why does anti-Semitism have a foothold around the world, some places perhaps more than others? Do you encounter it in your daily life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Lonnie Nossiter, a regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, where he oversees Wisconsin among five other states. And we're talking about a new survey now from the ADL, which shows that about a quarter of people worldwide hold anti-Semitic beliefs.
And you can join the conversation. What do you make of the findings our guest has been sharing? Why do you think anti-Semitism plays a big role in the world? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Lonnie, let's talk about the Holocaust. This was something else that your survey looked at. What did you find about attitudes surrounding the Holocaust today?
Sure. We found out that 54% of the people we polled had heard of the Holocaust before. So I guess the good news is that 54% of the world seems to know what it was. The bad news is that the other percentage, the 46%, don't know about the Holocaust. That's not good, which means we have education to do about this unique tragedy in history. But of the 54% that heard about the Holocaust, 33% of those that heard about it believed it was a myth or inaccurately described. So that's really troubling, the notion that of the 54%, a third of them believe that the Holocaust didn't happen or was fabricated in an effort for Jews to advance, et cetera, which is really troubling. And I think it kind of goes to a lot of what ADL does, and that is Holocaust education and making sure that notions of never again really do live on, that people understand that, you know, this is clearly documented, that the 6 million did in fact perish, and we hope and pray that that kind of thing will never happen again.
Let's go to our calls right now. We've got Scott on the line from Waukesha. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
It's interesting because your correspondent was just talking about the issue of Holocaust denial, and when I heard this topic, the very first thing I thought of was that, because I have had a number of students who enter my classes and they would say virulently that they're not anti-Semitic, and yet they have bought into elements of Holocaust denial and they want to revise ideas about the Holocaust. and there's no way to take that position, or there's no reason to take that position unless you harbor anti-Semitic feelings. So these are people who have anti-Semitic viewpoints, and yet they don't even recognize it, or at least they outwardly say that they don't.
All right. Thank you a lot. Thank you much for that comment, Scott. And Lonnie, what do you think about that comment that people harbor anti-Semitic beliefs, but they don't recognize that they do?
Yeah, that is something, and that's what's enlightening about this survey is, too, that it allows people to really think about the question about Jews and then answer, rather than just having an open-ended discussion, and there weren't really a way for us to chronicle whether or not we felt that they had strong anti-Semitic attitudes, which may be hard. This way, you kind of have pointed questions which would indicate a bias one way or the other. The issue of Holocaust denial, I think the caller was right, Scott, in terms of saying that, you know, if you deny the Holocaust, there has to be something lurking underneath that person, which really is something that has a deep animus against Jews, because at its core, it's essentially saying that the Jews were using this catastrophe to advance their cause, or, you know, maybe come up with the state of Israel, whatever it may be. I'm sure there's a theory behind it which is just so blatantly false, misleading, and clearly destructive.
It is striking that 54% of people had heard of the Holocaust, and, you know, that means, you know, the other rest of the 100% hadn't heard about it. I would have thought it was one of the top distinguishing historical markers of the last, you know, century. What do you make of that? Have you gotten to the point where you're drawing conclusions about the results of the survey?
Yeah, well, you know what? We also broke it down by age in terms of the Holocaust. So clearly, and also by region. So let's start with region first. In Western Europe, obviously, the numbers would indicate and made sense is that 94% are aware of the Holocaust. Eastern Europe, it's 82%. So in those regions where, unfortunately, the atrocities happened, there clearly is a recognition and an understanding of what went down. In other areas, in Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, however, it's less than 50%. And then with age, we notice that in respondents who are 50 or older, 61% were aware of the Holocaust, and under 35, 48%. So there is an age issue that we need to be cognizant of here, and that is the fact that, you know, if you, quote, lived through this, in the sense that, you know, you lived either during the Holocaust or you lived a little bit after it happened, you probably have a much better sense of its reality than you did if you're 20 years old or 23 when it happened, you know, 60 years ago.
And another striking fact, and this is something that you mentioned a bit ago, 70% of the people who expressed anti-Semitic views had never met a Jewish person. And I wonder what you make about that.
Yeah, that's it's a fascinating finding as well, is the notion that you hadn't met a Jew before, but a third of those or a quarter of those still harbor anti-Semitic attitudes. The only thing you can surmise is that the lack of exposure, unfortunately, has led to people believing what they read or what they hear, rather than having one-on-one, face-to-face exposure with Jews and being able to kind of hopefully deconstruct myths and stereotypes. You know, the lack of exposure would probably just lead one to believe that somehow, some way, they've heard about what Jews are and how they are represented in the world, and they've never had a Jewish person in front of them to rebut it.
Let's go back to the calls. Now we've got Chad joining us from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Chad.
Hi, how are we doing?
Good. What is your comment?
Well, I think it's mostly just a lack of, pretty much echoing what your guest is saying, that it's a lack of information, a lack of knowing. There's a lot of disinformation out there as well, you know, which has been going throughout history with the protocols of Zion. And I actually read a book by Abraham Foxman called Jews and Money, and it just goes through a lot of the stereotypes throughout history about why anti-Semitic views have started, and just throughout history when things have gone wrong in an era, a lot of times the default was to blame Jews for, you know, almost anything that would go wrong in society.
Yeah. And interestingly, Amanda and Rob and Chad, for that matter, so what we're finding also, which we thought, you asked me what were some of the surprises, in Western Europe, which the numbers are significantly lower than in Eastern Europe, there was one Western European country, it was Greece, that really went way higher than we ever anticipated. And that concerned us because it was so different than the rest of Western Europe. It was 69% of respondents in Greece polled very high in terms of anti-Semitic attitudes, and that goes exactly what he was saying. One can surmise that because of the economic collapse in Greece, people are potentially looking for a scapegoat, which unfortunately has, you know, Jews have been the beneficiary of that terrible notion for years and years, and one can probably take the leap that they're looking for people to blame, and unfortunately it's the Jews, coupled with a political party that has a very anti-Jewish motivational background behind it as well, in right now in Greece.
And in our last minute here, so the goal of the survey is to have data to mm-hmm. use to combat prejudice. Sure. How will you use these numbers going forward?
We'll use these numbers to educate. Thankfully, now with social media, no matter where you are in the world, you can get these numbers and look at them, and you can do a country-by-country analysis in terms of how the question is played out. But we really want, we want heads of state, we want people in these countries to look at these numbers, look at themselves in the mirror and say, is this accurate? Isn't this accurate? If they say this may be accurate, and hopefully they'll then say, then it's a problem, and we need to address it. And there's a lot of ways to address it, whether it be in the school systems, whether it be politically, culturally. There are ways to bring the number down. The United States is a perfect example how in just 45, 50 years we've gone significantly down in terms of anti-Semitic attitudes, and it's through a concerted effort by all different levels and levers to get those numbers down. But if people take it seriously, the needle can move.
Lonnie, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
That was Lonnie Nossiter, Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League, where he oversees a 6-state region, including Wisconsin, talking about a new survey measuring anti-Semitism worldwide. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, an aerospace engineer says it's time to get serious about pollution in Earth's orbit.
First, last summer, Governor Scott Walker and Republicans in the legislature approved a law that requires all doctors who perform abortions in the state to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of their clinic.
That regulation was put on hold, awaiting a court ruling on legal challenges. The trial begins today, began earlier today. It's expected to last through the week.
WPR reporter Gilman Halstead joins us from the courthouse now. Gil, good to have you.
Well, thanks for inviting me on.
Well, this ruling has been on hold pending the court's decision. What's the crux of the legal disagreement here?
Well, the crux is that the people challenging the law, Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, is that the law is unnecessary and will actually make it difficult for a large number of women to get an abortion because it will require the closing of a clinic where doctors have not, who perform the abortions there, have not been able to get the admitting privileges that the law requires.
And as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports it, they're contending also that certain doctors are being treated differently and, I guess, unfairly compared to other doctors. Is that something that you're seeing unfold?
Well, I don't know if I could use that value judgment being treated unfairly.
Well, that would be their argument, not.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I haven't even heard it stated that it's been unfair. It's more than that they have found it difficult to get these admitting privileges for a number of reasons that have been discussed during the testimony today. One is that the doctors contend that the hospitals don't want to give them admitting privileges because they won't be admitting very many patients, so they won't be providing business to the hospital, and the doctors, you know, find that sort of ironic because the reason that they are being asked to get admitting privileges is because there may be complications which are very rare, and so in order for them to get privileges, it would sort of, I mean, it sounds odd, but they would have to be able to guarantee that there'd be more complications in a procedure that is, by evidence, very rare. The other reason is that they believe some of the hospitals are concerned about having doctors that perform abortions having admitting privileges at their hospital, that stigma that might lead to protests outside of a hospital. All of the three doctors that testified today all talked about experiencing regular harassment in their work at the clinics as well as at their homes sometimes with threats and people going to their house, to their neighborhoods and knocking on doors and telling their neighbors that their neighbor is a murderer or a baby killer.
Now, should this law go into effect, how would different clinics in the state be affected?
Well, the contention of the people of the ACLU and Planned Parenthood is that because they haven't been able to get the admitting privileges required by the law, that they would have to close, one clinic would have to close in Milwaukee, and the other clinics where some doctors have finally been able to get admitting privileges would have to take up the slack. That would mean a much bigger load at those clinics, and it would mean that abortions would be delayed to later in the gestational period of the pregnancy, which makes them riskier, and that many people, women who, you know, don't want to be delayed for obvious reasons would end up having to go out of state and sometimes would not be able to do that just because of the time and expense involved in doing that, and therefore would be, their health would be put at risk.
Now, this case is expected to last about 4 days with a ruling,
right,
a decision coming within the next week or so after that. What has the scene been like at the courthouse today?
Well, it's been, I'd say it's been peaceful. There aren't any protesters outside, if that's what you mean. But this last bit of testimony that we've just been, I've just been listening to just before this call, has focused on some rather graphic descriptions of the few complications that at least one of these doctors was involved in having to deal with after she performed an abortion at a clinic and the patient had to be taken to a hospital. So that's been kind of a little bit difficult to listen to, and there have been some objections from the defense about how graphic things need to get in describing the problem. So that's, other than that, it's just been this. You know, these witnesses are the ACLU Planned Parenthood witnesses, and so they have sort of friendly questions, I guess you might call it, being asked of them, and then it's in the cross-examination from the Department of Justice attorneys that things get a little bit contentious.
Now, there are other states with similar laws, either on the books or in legal challenges we are seeing here in Wisconsin. How does Wisconsin's law, as it stands, compare to the rest of the country?
It's essentially the same law that's been challenged or enforced. In the, as I understand it, there are actually 8 states that have this law in effect. And I think we heard just in the story that Kristen Durst read from the Associated Press that Alabama and Mississippi, the law is on hold in a similar way as here. And in Texas, it was upheld after a court challenge.
And is there a chance that this will make it to the Supreme Court?
I don't know if I can make that kind of prediction, but I think it would be safe to predict that it's going to, no matter which way Judge Connolly here rules on it, it's going to end up at the 7th District Court of Appeals in Chicago, one side or the other, depending on how he rules. Well, I think it's pretty much guaranteed appeal it to that level.
And Gil, I want to ask you that one thing, one feature of the next 4 days in what's being decided there at the court is that there will be a trio of experts who will be sort of talking amongst each other, trying to get at some of the issues here. Can you describe what's going to happen then?
I have actually, I can't, Veronica, because I haven't been able to talk to any of the attorneys about what the sort of order of events is going to be in the trial. I mean, we heard 3 experts today, if that's what you're referring to, the ACLU's experts, and we're going to be hearing the Department of Justice witnesses as well, who will be supporting the law. I guess I hadn't heard that there was going to actually be an interchange between experts. I mean, they're going to be on the stand.
Right, and it's something I'd read in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article again, and it's I wish I could fill in more than my question, but it will be a trio of experts who will be kind of talking to each other, trying to get at different aspects of the case, but we can hear more about that as it unfolds later in the week.
Yeah, I look forward to being able to describe that to you, but there hasn't been any discussion about what that's going to be like. I was just expecting that we're going to hear doctors who have performed abortions who, as I said, the ACLU doctors say feel the law is both unnecessary and will cause problems for women, and those who say that we really need to have this law to protect the health of women.
And we'll leave it there. Gil, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Gil Halston, WPR reporter, covering the trial of Wisconsin's law that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. We hear a lot about pollution in the water, in the air, in the earth, but our next guest is setting his sights higher in our planet's orbit.
Tom Percy joins us now. He's an engineer, and he's a doctoral student in aerospace systems engineering at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. In a recent paper he co-wrote in the journal Space Policy, he makes the case that orbital debris is a threat to working satellites and the International Space Station, and that it's time for a cleanup. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tom, first of all, what is this debris? Where is it coming from in our orbit?
Well, we've been flying satellites in Earth orbit for over 55 years now, and we have a lot of satellites up there that are doing jobs like weather prediction and resource monitoring and communications. But over time, we've left a lot of things up there as well. Old satellites that they don't function anymore, rockets that took those satellites to orbit. And right now, of all the objects that we track in low Earth orbit especially, 96% of those objects are non-functioning things. Many of them are fragments of old satellites. So that leaves us with only about 415 active satellites and a whole lot of junk floating around them.
And how much of a threat is that junk to the good stuff, the stuff that's still working?
Well, all of that stuff is traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. And so you can imagine a freeway with a whole bunch of intersections and things moving very, very quickly. For the 415 active satellites, if we can see the objects, we can get out of their way and try to avoid running into them. But for many of the objects that are no longer controlled, when they run into each other, they create smaller debris, things larger than a marble, but smaller than a softball. And we estimate there are about 500,000 of those objects in low Earth orbit, each one of which could potentially be fatal if it collides with a satellite.
And there are a few people up there at the International Space Station. Have they been at risk? Have they had to dodge any of this?
They do from time to time. The orbit that the space station is in is relatively low in population, kind of by design. Mm-hmm. But from time to time, they do encounter objects that come within a certain distance of the space station. And they will have the crew get into their escape capsules and be ready to abandon the station if they have to. It's never come to that, thankfully, but there is a potential threat there.
In your paper, you make the case for some urgency. Why do we need to act soon on orbital debris?
Well, there's an idea called the Kessler syndrome that talks about the populations of these orbits increasing to the point where collisions become sort of a self-perpetuating chain reaction. And in cases like that, we can see very quickly an orbit becoming unusable. Too many objects to put an active satellite because it just stands too much of a risk of being hit by other things. For a long time, we operated under what was the big sky theory, that the sky is pretty big and satellites are pretty small. And in 2009, we had a collision between an active communication satellite and an old, unfunctioning Russian satellite. It was the first time that had happened, and it was kind of a wake-up call to the community that maybe the big sky theory wasn't exactly the way we want to operate. And there are some orbits that are very highly populated right now with many communication satellites and lots of debris. And so we're getting close to the point where some of those chain reaction events might actually take place.
In the meantime, more countries and more companies are sending up new stuff, right?
That's right. That's right. 20 years ago, there were only 15 countries, in the world that had satellites in orbit. Today, that number is 45, and it's becoming easier to fly satellites. The emergence of things like CubeSats that are relatively inexpensive, small and easy to make, actually lend themselves to student research opportunities. And so it's becoming that much easier to fly things in orbit as we get better at it.
Has there ever been an idea that when you send something up, you have to have a disposal plan, what it's going to do when it's done?
There are guidelines. Different licensing agencies within our country and then around the world and other space agencies have guidelines like something we call the 25-year rule, which says that you have to remove your satellite from orbit within 25 years of the end of its life. Unfortunately, they're not hard and fast rules. They're guidelines, and they sometimes are at odds with the economics of spaceflight. Satellites are expensive, and the longer they can stay up, the more revenue they can generate. And sometimes we just lose communication with the satellite before it has a chance to begin its deorbit procedure. And so what we're left with is a whole bunch of leftover satellites floating around waiting to run into something.
Also, if I've got a satellite and I have a choice between using its last little bit of juice to keep it working for 2 years or to move it and have it burn up in orbit, I might get that extra couple years out of it.
It's very tempting.
So there are two challenges, it seems like, to cleaning this up. Technical, which I want to get into in a minute, but policy, I want to start with. Who makes the decision on how to start cleaning this up, and what does it take to convince them to do that?
Sure. So the policy aspect is almost the more challenging of the two. A lot of people think of space kind of in the same vein of maritime law, where you can salvage things if you want to. That's actually not the case. The UN, the Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space, or COPUS, has set up some guidelines for how we're going to operate. And in space, the launching state, United States, Russia, China, owns those objects forever. And if we were to go up and try to retrieve an object that wasn't ours, that is in violation of international treaty. So ownership and liability become issues, along with the fact that if you develop something that can go harvest old space junk and deorbit it, you've also developed a platform that can harvest active satellites, which brings us into the realm of dual-use technology or weapons in space, which always makes people a little nervous.
Well, what would it take to have an international agreement that starts getting stuff out of orbit? Who would have to be at the table?
I think all the players are at the table. It's just a long process to discuss the ownerships and liabilities. There's an organization called the IADC that comprises 12 of the world's space agencies, NASA, the Japanese Space Agency, the Russian Space Agency, Europeans. And they're discussing regulations and liabilities and ownerships and those sorts of things on the global level. And at the same time, there are space agencies actively looking at ways to at least remove the things that they own. So there are steps being taken in the right direction, but it's a slow process when you're talking about international policy.
Well, yeah, it seems like there might be players out there who think, gosh, this is expensive. I've got a lot of other stuff I can put my money into. And, you know, I've just got a few satellites up there. They're probably not going to get hit with debris. What's in it for me to participate?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That's a definite concern, especially with the newer players in space who may only have one or two satellites. But what's interesting is the folks who have been flying in space the longest, Russia, China, America, are the ones who hold the bulk of the current debris that's up there. And so we have a lot of active satellites. We have a lot of debris, and trying to work within our own ownership is something that's possible. I think part of the challenge is that there are still some technical challenges that are going to require some investment in order to overcome. Not that they can't be overcome, but that it will take some money and some time to figure out how to do these things.
Yeah, and let's get into that now. We've covered the international politics side of it. Now, how physically do we make the debris go away?
Sure. So the challenge here is the small things that we cannot see. We can only see things from the ground that are bigger than a softball. That's the 11,000 objects that are in low Earth orbit right now. But the danger comes from the 500,000 things that are the size of a marble. Because we can't see them, we can't really do much about them in terms of remediation or removal. But what we can do is cut off their supply. If we stop allowing things to run into each other, large objects, then we can stop the growth of the smaller population. The challenge there is to remove the larger objects before they have a chance to run into things. In the short term, we do things like post-mission disposal, actually making it a little easier for companies and nations to make the decision to deorbit a satellite at the end of its mission. If we can get that compliance rate up a little bit, then we can slow the growth. And then long-term, actually developing satellites that will fly up to orbit and attach to old pieces of debris and start bringing them back in before they have a chance to run into each other and produce the dangerous small things that we're all worried about.
So scrubber satellites, do we have the technology to do that now?
We have the bits of technology. All of the major pieces are there. It's the integration of the systems and making them function in space and in the manner that we need them to. Most of these objects are not objects that were designed to be rendezvoused with in space, and this is a delicate maneuver. It's a challenge even for rendezvousing capsules with the space station, which we do fairly regularly. To go and grab something that was never intended to be grabbed presents its own unique set of challenges. And then beyond that, the altitude has a major impact on our ability to actually remove them economically. We'd like to take advantage of things like drag, but that doesn't always present itself to us, so we have to do things with propulsion, and that's expensive. And so the pieces are there, our ability to rendezvous, our ability to grab things, but making them work in this type of a situation and making it economical is a challenge.
Briefly, before we wrap up, are you a lone voice in the wilderness, or are people starting to take this seriously?
No, people are starting to take this very seriously. We have an office within our own space agency at Johnson Space Center that tracks orbital debris. The Air Force is very much interested in the congestion of low Earth orbit. On the international scale, we have committees with the UN and other space agencies all looking at different ways to fix this problem, both mathematically and engineering-wise. We even had hearings with the Committee on Space Science and Technology in the U.S. House of Representatives just a couple of weeks ago to talk about the problem and try to decide where we can invest our resources. So people are talking about it, but the more opportunities we get to talk about it and let the general public know what's going on, I think the more traction we'll be able to get.
Well, thanks for talking to us about it today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
That's Tom Percy. He's an engineer, and he's at the University of Alabama in Huntsville.